This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiaoyik. It's our Doctor in House segment, and in conjunction with World Sexual Health Day, which falls on 4th of September every year, we are going to take a look at how we're doing in managing sexually transmitted infections in Malaysia. And we are going to focus more on the stigma surrounding STIs. They are a taboo subject in our society. The surrounding stigma can prevent early detection and treatment of these diseases. So we want to look at how the conversation has changed over the years and what kind of taboos we are still dealing with today. So, of course, consultant urologist Dr. George Lee is on the line to join us with this conversation, as well as Associate Professor Dr. Raja Iskandar Shah Raja Azwar from the Faculty of Medicine and University of Malaya. How are the both of you today?
Fantastic. Thank you very much.
I'm very excited because I always ask Iskandar to help me when I encounter very complex sexually transmitted infections. So today I'm looking forward to finding out more about the trend and what's going on in on the ground.
And speaking of trends, what are we seeing in terms of sexually transmitted infections in Malaysia right now? What's the prevalence that we're talking about?
So unfortunately, out of all the sexually transmitted infections that is reported, HIV is the one that's reported the most and gains most of the prominence in terms of data reporting. When it comes to the other sexually transmitted infections, they tend to be less. Certainly, if you think of other infections like gonorrhea, syphilis, hepatitis B probably, Well, chlamydia is not even a notifiable disease in this country. So I think two things compound the problem with reporting of sexually transmitted infections. A lot of people access private healthcare with expectation that they will receive a confidential consultation and less likely to report diseases. So there's a bias there already in terms of reporting. So, you know, and I think that that has a lot to do with what's actually being reported out there at the moment.
And when it comes to HIV, which we have the bulk of the data, what is the prevalence right now and what are the trends of infections?
So in terms of HIV, so which we have most of the data, it's sort of plateaued at around about 3,000, if I remember correctly, the latest data, and sort of around that level. Most of it is sexually transmitted now, so I think more than 90% in the 2019 data is sexually transmitted. Due to the successful harm reduction program, we're seeing a lower number of cases due to injecting drug use, so we've done very well in terms of the response there. And there's more sexual transmission attributable to men who have sex with men, and that seems to be going up year on year.
Yeah. I mean, I'm glad you highlighted that 90% is actually sexually transmitted. Presumably, the needle sharing kind of practice is no longer an issue. And also, I gather that maternal screening is also one of the factors that reduce vertical transmissions of HIV from mother to children. Is that true?
Right. Okay. So Malaysia has a highly effective screening program for pregnant women, and often in the public sector, reaching often more than 90% of pregnant women. It has resulted essentially in significant reductions in mother-to-child transmission as a result. And I think one of the few countries within the Asia-Pacific to be recognized for elimination of mother-to-child transmission. But that's across all forms of transmission, be it sexual or through injecting drug use. It's not specific. I mean, that's just an intervention to reduce mother-to-child transmission. And also, as mentioned previously, the harm reduction program, which was successful in reducing new transmissions due to injecting drug use.
So, you know, taking all of that into consideration and some of the successes that we've had, is HIV still a concern when it comes to sexual health issues in Malaysia? Or are, should we be turning our attention to the other STIs where you've said that there is quite a data gap?
Well, I mean, so HIV in this country over the past 10 years, incidence has been, number of new cases have been directly related to sexual transmission and continues to be a concern. So I don't think they should be segregated. I think they should be thought of as under sort of one whole agenda, if you like. You know, STIs are not really, people like talking about it. People like, especially, you know, in dinner parties and things like that. But when it comes to policy making and things around that, it becomes less of an issue. It becomes more of a taboo in settings like that. I don't think you can separate HIV from STIs because one facilitates the other. And they sort of come in groups. And so therefore, if you have a sexually transmitted HIV epidemic, if you don't address the sexually transmitted infection, then you're not going to solve the whole problem of a sexually transmitted HIV epidemic. I think policymakers need to be sensitized to the issues around sex, need to be more comfortable to address consequences of unprotected sex as a public health issue. Rather than a moralized issue, I think, which we've been doing for so long. And until we can do that, you know, we're never going to move forward.
Yeah. Iskandar, I totally agree with you. Coming back to the issues about the data gap, right? You highlighted earlier on that there are certain diseases which are notifiable diseases to the Ministry of Health, certain are not. Can you clarify for the listeners, out of all the sexually transmitted infection, for example, hepatitis B, for example, hepatitis C, syphilis, herpes, chlamydia, gonorrhea, which ones are notifiable and which ones are not? And what sort of data do we have on those diseases?
Okay, the most common, I think the greatest data that we have got is probably from the last one that I've seen was from HKL because they have a standalone public sector sexually transmitted clinic on site. And a lot of the data is actually drawn from there. Looking at that data specifically, and that's from a couple of years back, the most common reportable sexually transmitted infection tends to be gonorrhea. And that's understandable. It tends to be screening tends to be largely directed in this country towards patients who have symptoms rather than those who don't have symptoms. And so gonorrhea tends to be more symptomatic. It's understandable, therefore, why it is the most common reportable infection. This is then followed by probably syphilis, but depending on which population group you are screening. So syphilis is less common, let's say, in heterosexuals in this country. Is very common in men with sex with men and in sex workers and clients of sex workers. They're very much concentrated within that population. Chlamydia is not a reportable infection. And in fact, I think women should be shouting out and saying, you know, this is, in fact, it's a disservice to women, especially young women in this country, because global data show that chlamydia is certainly the most common sexually transmitted infection in young women, certainly in countries, and especially in developed countries, where screening programs exist to screen young women without any infections. So I think on the whole, these are probably globally the three most common sexually transmitted infections. HPV is probably the most common sexually transmitted infection that we see, but it's not something that you would screen routinely because how you approach HPV or human papillomavirus is largely from the manifestation of the virus in itself, so which is either genital warts or many, many years later in the form of genital cancer as a result of HPV infection.
How can we improve our sensitivity towards the STIs that are less symptomatic then?
Well, so first of all, to basically probably normalize STI screening,
provided opportunistically in to populations of groups which are at higher risk of sexually transmitted infections. So the youth, for example, we know that university students are probably having more sex and more unprotected sex than everybody else, partly because it is associated with sexual debut and some form of risk taking at the time of experimenting with sex. So normalized testing, making it less invasive, so offer screen tests on less invasive specimens rather than so such as urine and not on swabs, for example. You know, the dreaded urethral swab in men now no longer needs to be done in the setting of these newer PCR or nucleic acid amplification tests. And I think people, a lot of people who are concerned about testing for sexually transmitted infection are still think that you have to use maybe a urethral swab to diagnose a urethral sexually transmitted infection. But also we need to get people talking about STIs and normalize sexual health. I mean, you know, George has done a brilliant job around that in some of the talks that he has done. We need to feel comfortable with that, irrespective of everything else, you know?
Yeah. I think one of the issues that I encounter when I give, awareness talks, number one is the cost of the screening. Because at the moment, obviously, that is an obstacle that some people might find it difficult to bear the cost. The second one actually is not knowing who to go to if they encounter such problems, because many physicians, patients worry about there are no physicians or clinicians being judgmental, because like you said, the only government establishment which has designated genital unit infection unit is in GHKL. So can you tell us how we can overcome those obstacles?
Right. Okay. So one way is, so Malaysian AIDS Council should or has started work on HIV treatment directories, whereby certain clinics are recognized for producing, procuring HIV and supplying HIV treatment. We, in some of the work that I've done around HIV pre-exposure prophylaxis, which is a HIV prevention pill, we've worked with WHO to encourage clinics that are able to provide and are trained to provide HIV pre-exposure prophylaxis to register themselves on a clinic website called the preplocator.org, which is So what they have to do is they log on to and enroll onto an online course which deals with HIV pre-exposure prophylaxis, and then they subsequently have to attend several sessions with a HIV or a HIV prevention clinic provider, and then they're able to register their clinic as a PrEP provider. Now these clinics also deal with populations with high rates of sexually transmitted infections. And I think maybe that's a start, although this is largely targeted at clinics which provide pre-exposure prophylaxis, but it's more or less on the same theme in dealing with populations or groups which are at greater risk of sexually transmitted infections. And I think this is probably one of the few directories that are able to direct you to clinics that provide these services. Now, they're a mixture of government and private clinics, and I think it's a start, you know, in terms of answering that question, where do I go? It's also very much gender-based. I think a lot of women go to gynecologists or go to their gynecologist, and I think that's very much been the norm in this country. They feel more comfortable going to a gynecology service as opposed to a separate sexual health service, and males often traditionally have gone to either a urologist or a dermatologist. But this directory is clinics providing that sort of specialized sexual health service.
Do you see additional barriers, Dr. Iskandar, when it comes to communities outside of the urban middle income group? And what are the kinds of challenges in terms of reaching them?
Yeah, so for the private setup, it largely caters to people who can afford to pay the tests. And George alluded to the cost of some of these tests being fairly expensive, and that in itself prevents healthcare providers from number one, offering the test, and number two, when offered, patients are less likely to take up the test because of cost. I guess it boils down to demand and supply, and the greater demand you have, you at least have room to negotiate the cost of these prices, and therefore there's room for creating these specialized clinics which cater to these specialized services where, and there's room, as I said, room to negotiate. Now, in circumstances, of course, where tests have become too expensive, then I guess the only way of treating largely then, or screening therefore largely relies on what has been done and advocated by WHO for a very long time, which is a syndromic management that largely relies on patients presenting with symptoms. You're not really taking into account the huge bulk of STIs, which is largely asymptomatic. This is a universal problem across countries, across the region, trying to get these newer chlamydia and gonorrhea PCR or nucleic acid amplification tests down. It has not been a major priority of WHO, but it's work which is currently being done, and a lot of the work driving it is because pre-exposure prophylaxis provision is being scaled up in countries across Southeast Asia and has got people to start thinking at least, how can I bring the current prices of STI tests, in particular chlamydia and gonorrhea nucleic acid amplification tests, down? The blood tests, on the other hand, are very cheap. So blood test for syphilis is very cheap in comparison. A blood test for HIV, looking at antibodies and antigen, is very cheap in comparison.
And the ones that you were talking about before then that are more costly, which are those?
So those are tests for chlamydia and gonorrhea.
Okay.
But PCR-based tests. So using non-invasive tests, and non-invasive specimens such as urine, for example.
All right. I'm speaking to consultant urologist Dr. George Lee, as well as Associate Professor Dr. Raja Iskandar Shah Raja Azwar from the Faculty of Medicine at University of Malaya. This is our Doctor in the House series. We're observing World Sexual Health Day, and we've been discussing sexually transmitted infections, the tests that are available for STIs, and also the barriers that prevent people from accessing these tests. Some of these barriers include the cost, as well as the urban-rural divide. Coming up after the break, we'll take a look if conversations and stigma surrounding sex and sexually transmitted infections have been changing. We'll be right back on Health and Living, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living. I'm T. Xiao Yik. On the line with me today, consultant urologist Dr. George Lee and Associate Professor Dr. Raja Iskandar Shah Raja Azwar from the Faculty of Medicine at University of Malaya. This is our Doctor in the House show today. We are commemorating World Sexual Health Day, which falls on the 4th of September every year, and we are discussing sexual health as well, particularly sexually transmitted infections. I'd like to look at the narrative around STIs in Malaysia. And you said earlier that, STIs is a topic that we may joke about, behind covered hands, but when it comes to having proper conversations about it, where are we? How has that conversation changed over the years that you've been practicing?
Very little, I think. A lot of it has to do with funding and priority. STIs tend to come down the list of funding priorities regionally, globally, and competing health priorities are taken more seriously. It always helps if you have data. I think if you have data to show that a particular STI is of a significant problem, there is a platform to ask for funding. But I think we've been stuck in this in this arena of whether we should be offering more opportunistic screening as opposed to just treating patients with symptoms over the past 10 years. But as I said, HIV pre-exposure prophylaxis is at least beginning to change that discussion. And I think we'll begin to see cheaper points of care tests, which is what we want, rapid tests and cheaper tests within the near future. Yeah, hopefully.
How much of that, Dr. Iskandar, do you think has to do with people's perceptions of sexually transmitted infections and that reluctance to acknowledge that this could happen to me?
Right. Yes, I think that's very much the case. I think a lot of people think that sexually transmitted infections is somebody else's problem. And therefore, it's something that does not really affect them. So, but you know, how much, there's not much, you don't get a sense that there's much, you know, because of cultural and religious sensitivities, a lot of it is not put out there. And therefore, the awareness is less. And therefore, the discussions and narratives are not happening as where it should be, you know? And, so I think that's part of the problem. And the youth as well feel, you know, generally feel a sense of invincibility. And also the fact that a lot of people, feel that the consequences of sexually transmitted infections are not that bad. You get symptoms, you get treated, and everything becomes better. I mean, and most of the time that narrative works. However, what we don't see is the consequences of chronic pelvic pain, of infertility, secondary to chlamydia. I mean, let me throw this question to you. How many times has a gynecologist offered maybe you or a friend of yours a chlamydia test when you see the gynecologist?
So it will be shock.
I must say, not at all. Like you said, it's only based on if you come with a complaint.
And how do you feel, Shari, if somebody just routinely asks you, do you think you would like to have a an STI check?
I mean, that's fair, isn't it? Because we are talking about a checkup just like any other issue. And in fact, Dr. Iskandar, should it not extend to GPs as well?
Absolutely. GPs are probably the best doctors, groups of doctors to offer this because sexual health shouldn't really be specialized. It should be part of general overall health. Whether it's directed to women, men, or young people, they're certainly best placed. In countries like the UK, GPs have taken on a lot of sexual health services, and rightly so. They are probably the best person to offer that, best groups of doctors to offer that.
I totally agree with you that, in the more conservative environment, sexual health, it's kind of like perceived separately. And a lot of ignorance, like you said, younger demographic may take sexual health more risky. They have more high risk behavior because they don't think it'll ever happen to them, or they assume that the partner will definitely be clean. And then also on the other hand, people who contracted this, the sense of guilt that they encounter. And also that sort of like, self-inflicted attitudes towards them, that this is a condition that they self-inflicted. I think those are the things that we should really eliminate in order to have a proper dialogue without discrimination.
Absolutely. Completely agree with you, George.
George, what do you observe? You are not directly a provider of sexual health services, but it is part of your scope as well.
Well, in the UK setting, like Iskandar mentioned before, that genital urinary medicine is a separate entity. But in Malaysian setting, if a man encountered problem with suspected sexually transmitted infection, they will either go to dermatology, I repeat, dermatology, or they come to urology. Mm. And a lot of time in urology curriculum, sexually transmitted infection is actually number one, not higher up, number two, not even included in the urology specialist training. So therefore, there is a gap in the interest of people who really like to provide this. And when you said that I'm not directly involved, in fact, on a daily basis, I actually get clients who presented with either exposure, suspected infection, or just do a screening test in order to make sure that they're not taking anything home. And the most interesting thing is that a lot of time when you ask them to register, they either don't give you their real name or they tell you that, you know, they are either called John Smith, which we have quite a lot of them. We have quite a lot of number John Smiths. And then so I think that reflects that guilt and worry. They have concerns what I'm going to do with them, incriminating them if they are found to have a disease that is so presumed to be shameful in air quotes.
What, Dr. Iskandar, what can we learn from HIV if we go on from George's point about that shame and that fear of being stigmatized?
So a lot of this shame and stigma is also self-stigma and internalized stigma, that patients are judging themselves before they've even walked in the door of the clinic, but compounded by the fact that if you if you then consult a doctor who is not used to or sensitive around issues around sexual health, sometimes that can be made worse. Mm-hmm. Now, and which is often such a shame, because then the person never comes back again, never gets screened again, and the whole cycle itself continues. The patient ends up having to look for a different provider. So, I think there are a lot of similarities between HIV and STI. The stigma, both by the patient as well as the stigma by unsensitized healthcare providers who are not really used to providing these services. I mean, it doesn't really take much to be a provider who provides sexual health services. You're really asking a doctor to be non-judgmental, maintain confidentiality of the patient, treat the patient humanely, and with dignity. So I think, and often we find that within the healthcare provider setting, even that is not possible, which is such a shame, which is why I think patients end up seeking specialized services by providers which provide these services.
You know, we've addressed where they go within the healthcare setting, but a lot of people in Malaysia, in Asia, also resort to alternative or complementary therapies. What are the issues there?
I think less so with sexually transmitted infections. In my practice, I think often if somebody comes with, let's say, a urethral discharge or a vaginal discharge, they often want to get rid of it fairly quickly. And I think in my practice anyway, people are less likely to dabble in alternative treatments.
All right. What about, if we are still on the topic of just the conversations around sexual health, we don't even have to talk about sexually transmitted diseases yet. But like you said earlier, just the general taboo talking about sex and the issues around that. Number one, what are your thoughts on comprehensive sexuality education in Malaysia, which has been on the table for decades and has not gotten anywhere? And number two, social media, what kind of impact has that been having?
Yeah, I think many years of or can we get it right by the Ministry of Higher Education, I think they have finally got something together from what I'm told by the Ministry of Health. So I think there is the beginnings of some form of comprehensive sexual education, but which is, of course, I think maybe not completely comprehensive in the sense that it's, I think it's, they're just experimenting with it initially, and so it's not fully comprehensive. But I think at least something is finally starting, and it's sort of 20 years delayed. Mm. I think a lot of these sexual education programs are probably best run by the youth. We underestimate what the youth are able to do, and it's a problem predominantly as well in younger people. So and they're masters of social media, so it's a great way of reaching, of having a greater reach overall. I think the current sexual education programs are employing different platforms of social media, but I think we really should let the young lead the way when it comes to something like this, because it's something that they should overall oversee, and it's directed largely to them as well.
Did you hear that, George? The young.
Yes, yeah, including me.
Absolutely.
I totally agree. I mean, there's something that I don't think about it that way, because as the kind of the older clinician, you always assume that the young will not take responsibility of less risk, you know, taking behavior in sex. But the thing is, social media they'll reach out to social media for knowledge. And what better way if they're involved in the dialogue in the first place, and then actually encourage each other how to have the dialogue. And I really think Iskanda is absolutely right. This is the way forward.
You know, George, you're an educator as well. And you've also talked about how in the discipline of urology, there is so little attention given to sexually transmitted infections. So how do you bridge that gap?
Well, in the education viewpoint, and then I teach for a university that's affiliated with Australia. And then sometimes the curriculum is the same. So there are sexually sensitive topics that may arise. Let's say, for example, anything in the LGBT kind of like areas of sensitivity. And a lot of the time, lecturers will choose to self-censor because of worrying about offending other people. And despite that being self-censored, I would like to open up those sort of like topics for the students to discuss, because a lot of time, the modern teaching of medicine involves a lot of discussion, such as problem-based learning. And I really think it's a good platform for the youth and also my students to discuss issues that are not in the textbooks. And then that is it. A good way that is not curated, it's not dictated by the curriculum, however, have open opportunities for students to have discussions of the areas that they feel is important and may not be covered by the curriculum. And I take that as a way to overcome obstacles when it comes to sexually trans or taboo of sex education. Iskanda is also an educator in the most renowned medical school in Malaysia. How is that overcome?
Well, I tend to push barriers in when I talk about sexually transmitted infections. I mean, I have a lot of great admiration for George in what he does when he talks a lot about issues around sexual health and STI. He's very out there, he is, and he's very, he challenges a lot of people when it comes to issues like this. I do the same in sort of a more conservative environment in university layer, but it gives, I don't think you can have this conversation around sexual health, STI, without asking what the students think about them. They need to be involved in that discussion. So it's never a lecture. It's always a two-way conversation. I am always interested to know what people think about an area which is still very much stigmatized so long after. Whereas at a time where students really should know, should really be open to discussing this. Now, sexual health is not rocket science. It's easy to do. What's difficult is everything else around it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's condoms. It's protect yourself with condoms. And nowadays, it's you have a biochemical intervention, so condoms or PrEP. And there are other things, of course. Abstinence is thrown in. post-exposure prophylaxis, regular screening for sexual transmitted infections. There's a whole toolbox now, but it isn't rocket science. And it hasn't changed dramatically over the number of years. But what hasn't moved is just the access to these interventions, you know? Mm. I mean, students, I mean, we should be able to display condoms where they're most needed, you know? And the youth should not be afraid to be able to walk into a 7-Eleven store and feel that he or she is being judged for buying condoms. We can learn a lot from STIs, also from contraception and how young women exert contraception in this country, which is, you know, still the number of young women on contraception in this country is still very, very low. And as a result, you know, we also have a problem with unplanned pregnancies in this country. Mm-hmm. So, you know, let's not also dissociate that conversation from STI. This is basically the comfort level that our population has about talking about issues around sex and how comfortable we are accessing these preventative measures, ultimately.
Dr. Iskander, I'm curious. So when you have those open conversations with your students, when you ask them what they think, what they feel, how do they respond?
I think a lot of the time, if they're given the platform to talk about this, irrespective of culture, religion, I think, first of all, they're grateful for their engagement. That's the sense of what I get. Mm-hmm. And secondly, we always try and approach it from a public health point of view. And I think if you can dissociate that from a moralized and a religious point of view and try, and it's the same with COVID and the problem, for example, of COVID in the US. If people and leaders just looked at it from a public health point of view, so the consequences, in this case of what we're seeing of unprotected sex and dealing with that, then I think the conversation just flows and I think becomes a more productive conversation. People are they are highly receptive to it. It's not a conversation they do not want to be a part of. They want to be a part of, because the invitation to participate in conversations like this is generally relatively rare.
Mm. And, you know, speaking of COVID, Dr. Iskander, you talked earlier about STIs and sexual health already being very low in terms of policy priorities, in terms of funding priorities. Do you foresee COVID further impacting this?
Well, I think COVID, certainly during times of lockdown, I think probably would, if we were screening enough, would have a beneficial effect on STIs. I think in some countries it has shown that during lockdowns, that people were generally not engaged, people were abiding by the restrictions and mm-hmm. not having too much sex in between. And this is data from countries like mainly in the UK and other countries. And then provided actually an ideal opportunity to screen patients at the end or just before the lockdown ended, and then screen them, treat them, and, you know, you could solve that issue more or less of well, not entirely, but, you know, you could at least address the issue of sexually transmitted infection. So I think people probably are, in the beginning, were more cautious of engaging in intimacy because of wanting to respect the restrictions. Mm-hmm. And people were scared, of course, as well, you know.
All right. We're running out of time. Can I get each of you to share a message for World Sexual Health Day? Dr. Iskander?
I think we need to normalize that discussion around sex. I think we need to feel comfortable about talking about sex, and we need to have a more open conversation about the consequences of unprotected sex. We need to bring contraception and women into this conversation. HPV has done a lot for women, but I think, you know, issues around HPV, still a lot of people feel uncomfortable about talking. So yes, and screen. Get tested. And get tested if you feel you're at risk. irrespective of whether you have symptoms.
George?
Well, I really want to echo that sexual health is part of your overall, overall health, really. So why does it have to be separate? I think it's only separate because sex is always perceived as something that one shouldn't be doing and should be sinful. And I really think in 21st century, that sort of mentality should really be eliminated. And who better to spearhead that sort of mentality will be the youth, as suggested by Iskandar, that, you know, if the youth can take responsibility of their own health, then they can take responsibility to disseminate better sexual health information.
Thank you so much. I've been speaking to consultant urologist Dr. George Lee and Associate Professor Dr. Raja Iskandar Shah Raja Azwar from the Faculty of Medicine at University of Malaya. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.